Coming up on Golf Today, to quote Mike Singletary, we want winners. Rory McIlroy defending his title at the CJ Cup in South Carolina and vaulting back into the top spot in the official world golf ranking. How long will Rory stay there? And Lydia Ko securing another LPGA title in Korea, now leading the Player of the Year race. Is she the best player in the world right now? Plus, Stephen Alker continues his magical run on the PGA Tour Champions. Is there any way he drops out of the top spot in the Charles Schwab Cup playoff race? We're going to have that all coming up next.
Golf Today.
Rory had bogeyed the 17th, built up a little cushion, just needed to bogey the last for the victory, and is able to get it done. McIlroy, a one-shot win at the CJ Cup. You see final round 67, match Kitayama shot for shot. K.H. Lee, solid week, not pictured in our highlights, solo third finish. John Rahm and a hard closing Tommy Fleetwood, a share of fourth. Fleetwood turning in a 65. Most PGA Tour wins we were thinking since 2017-18 season. You see this list. Rory now the only player with double-digit wins in the PGA Tour, Eamon.
Send in a message. 23 in total.
McIlroy with the media after the dub.
Someone had told me on the Friday night of the Valero Texas Open when I missed the cut that I'd be world number one by October. I would have asked them what they were smoking because I would not have believed them. So, it's just been a wild 6 months. You know, I figured a few things out with my game, and I've just been on a really good run. Everything sort of feels like it's came together for me, and today was just a continuation of how I've felt like I've been playing over these last few months. And now it's all about going forward and trying to just keep this going. But it's amazing. It's a lot to process right now just with everything, but just really proud of myself with how I handled this week, knowing what was at stake and really just, you know, how I've played over these last few months. You know, this tournament last year was the start of me trying to build myself back up to this point. You know, I had a really rough Ryder Cup. You know, I've talked about that at length. I think I was outside the top 10 in the world. You know, it's not a position that I'm used to being in. And I think just the steady climb back up to the summit of world golf and what it takes, right? And what it takes, and it's not just me, it's everyone that's a part of my team. It's not a solo effort. And I just think about everyone that's made a difference in my life. Obviously not over the last 12 months, but ever, but it's you know, just thinking over that last 12 months, there's a lot of people that deserve a lot of the plaudits, and you know, I'm the one that sits up here and takes them, but there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes that people don't know about, and all of that stuff combined is just as important as what I do out there trying to get these wins. So it's a team effort, and I think whenever I think about that, I that's what gets me a little bit choked up and emotional, because it's really cool to be on this journey with other people that you want to be on the journey with, you know, and that's a really cool part of it.
An attitude of gratitude for Rory McIlroy, and he has once again ascended to the throne in the official world golf ranking, number one, knocking off Scottie Scheffler, slides to number two. You see Cam Smith, Patrick Cantlay, John Rahm rounding out your top five. You hear Rory in the media center, and you can see why he's one of the top personalities in the professional game, with how introspective he is and then how freely he shares his perspective. Your biggest takeaway from what's now unfolded for him to ascend in the last 12 months from outside the top 10 back to number one?
It's not just the winning to me, George. It's the manner of the winning we've seen out of Rory McIlroy and who he was winning against. Because yesterday, while Kurt Kitayama finished second, it seemed to be a Rory McIlroy-John Rahm head-to-head that was built up, and Rory McIlroy stuck his foot on the gas despite those couple of misfires when he'd given himself breathing room over the last couple of holes. But we saw the same at Eastlake in the FedEx Cup when he went toe-to-toe with Scotty Scheffler down the stretch. We saw the same at the RBC Canadian Open against Justin Thomas and Tony Finau, and he's sending a message as well. There's kind of an alpha dog mentality that you see in there, which isn't often associated with Rory, certainly in this, I suppose, the second chapter of his career. It was certainly in the first chapter of his career we saw more of that. And I think he's also sending a message that he hasn't lost a step. And we don't talk about longevity very much with 33-year-olds. But if you go back and look, March 4th in 2012, that was the day Rory McIlroy first ascended to number one in the world. These are the guys who were in the top 10 in the world then and where they are now. And he's really the only one who's really still relevant. Obviously, number eight there, Dustin Johnson, has left PGA Tour and is at LIV now, not accumulating world ranking points. But Rory is back in that position, and everyone else is essentially, all those show horses have gone to the glue factory at this point. And it's just, to me, an interesting statement. Even where he was, we heard him talk about where he was a year ago after that brief spell of working with Pete Cowan, where his game fell off dramatically. His world ranking tumbled at the same time. And it was the CJ Cup last year was his first victory after he'd gone back to work with Michael Bannon, his childhood coach. You're seeing the results of a guy who seems to be very comfortable where he is with his game.
I think this next stage of his career will go far in defining his legacy. And Rory's just 33 years old. And we forget how young he is in golf years, just because the window for when guys reach the peak in their career has skewed so much younger with what Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas, Colin Morikawa, John Rahm, all these guys did right out of college. You forget that Phil Mickelson didn't win his first major till 34 and then had six from 34 up to 50, had a 16-year window that Rory hasn't even reached yet at 33 years old. So I'm curious not only what he can accomplish with 23 PGA Tour wins, if and when he can break that major victory drought, but he can also ascend to be kind of this generation's Arnold Palmer, in my opinion. He's going to be that personality that helps carry the PGA Tour from a leadership standpoint, from being one of the guys who has the pedigree and cachet to have the respect of his peers, that I think he can be not only the European Arnold Palmer, but kind of carry that over here. But we'll see if and when the major drought is going to be the big storyline that we come into 23, came so close in 22. When is he going to get that moniker off his back and play the golf that we know he's capable of in majors?
And it's so easy when you're in a position like Rory McIlroy, particularly when you're being positioned as the spokesperson for the PGA Tour during the most tumultuous period in the history of the game, to let everything else slide, to kind of have, you have a built-in excuse for results not coming. If you're Rory McIlroy, it seems to be a little more fuel that you want to make a statement. And he kind of isolates where his weaknesses are. And it's a never-ending process with him. And he had some really interesting sound yesterday. Todd Lewis spoke to him on the 18th green, and I was struck by Rory McIlroy's answer to one question. Let's listen to it.
What do you enjoy more about the game now?
I think just the journey of trying to get the best out of myself. I think that's the satisfying thing. I'd never feel like I've figured this game out. I don't think I ever will figure it out, but every day I wake up trying to get closer.
And that's not just a matter of perspective. There's actually granular detail to that. If you look at his long maligned wedge game, George, last year, his wedge distance, basically from 50 yards to 150 yards, he ranked pretty poorly. From, you know, from 50 to 125, he was tied for 164th on tour. From 125 to 150, he was 86th on tour. He's now inside the top 30 in both of those categories. He's 16th in strokes gained putting when he was well outside the top 100 a few years ago. He's isolating weaknesses and just kind of pushing forward.
And I also think going forward, and we're clearly seeing that inside the ropes with his game and the results on the PGA Tour, it seemed like the Ryder Cup was kind of the trough. I want to say like rock bottom, but that was the dip that got his attention on, okay, I need to assess where these weaknesses are. I was talking with Rory last week at the CJ Cup. He's already pinpointing how the composition of the European Ryder Cup team is going to look next year, and then what he can try and implement to try and help Europe have some type of, not edge, but maximize what the team's going to look like with all these young guys coming in. It was interesting to hear his thoughts 12 months out, and that's already, if not the focal point, kind of the side burner for where his attention is and where he's building towards.
And if the last 12 months has taught us anything, it means you can't predict anything for the next 12 months, George.
How about this? Final round, 65, 21 under par. Wins by four. Gets to enjoy it. So the final scores from the BMW Ladies Championship in South Korea. Just building the suspense. Andrea Lee was solo second. Three players you see tied for third at 16 under par. Arya Jatanagarn, a Sunday 70, finishing T7. So Ko now, two wins this season. Let's hear from Lydia after getting number two.
How do you make the game look so easy?
If only it was easy. It was a pretty packed leaderboard, and going into today, you know, especially with how Ataya has been playing, I knew that I needed to have my A game, and I think I set a goal of 5 under, and if somebody plays better than me and I don't end up winning, you know, that's all I can do. So I just try to focus on me. Definitely made the 18th hole a little harder than it actually should be played, but you know, it's great to be back in the winner's circle, and I think it means a lot to win in Korea, where it's a place that I'm born, and I think makes it very special.
Oh, I can imagine. I mean, it's like you've won all around the world. This is your 18th win on the LPGA Tour, and you've won everywhere, but this is the first win in the country of your birth, and I can see how much it means to you.
Yeah.
Well, you've been absolutely remarkable, and to have two wins in 2022, because it's been a difficult few years for you, but you've come back, you fell outside of the top 50, you're now five, you're going to get higher in the game. You must be so proud of how hard that you've worked.
I don't think I could be here without the help of my family and my friends and my sponsors. And I think my team has really trusted me more than I trusted myself at times. And coming into this week, I think I said more than ever, I really want to win in Korea once before my career is done. And to be able to do that, and a few of my relatives are here, and this is the first year since COVID that we've had fans, I think it means a lot. And, you know, a win is special in its own way. I can't say which one of the 18 is better than the others, but I think this is one to cherish. And I wanted to finish off this season strong. I only have two more events this year, and to be able to win here, I don't think I have any complaints for 2022.
Yeah, each win a different chapter in the story of her career, and you can see just how meaningful that was. Number 18, we're going to go rewind it to her first. That was 10 years ago. This from the LPGA Tour. Lydia Ko picking up her first victory. That was the CN Canadian Women's Open. And how many wins has she piled up since now with 18? We're just trying to think of that pace before turning 26. Some of the greats in the game, how many wins they had. Crazy that Annika had four and wound up with 72. You see Mickey Wright, Kathy Whitworth, Lydia actually on pace with those two names. So with that in mind, let's welcome in our Paige McKenzie, who's on site this week at the Eastlake Cup. Paige, your thoughts on Lydia's big win?
It's been an incredible trajectory, not only the season, but especially these recent results. I can go back to actually last week. I was asked to come up with a segment. It said, you know, tell me I'm wrong. Anybody that's watching this show knows that segment. And my tell me I'm wrong that ended up on the cutting room floor was Lydia Ko is the best player in the world. And it was based on her recent results. So to say that this was a surprise would be a complete understatement based on how she's been playing. But I think it also speaks to kind of what's going on at the top of the world rankings in the women's game right now. Jin Young Ko, unfortunately, we heard about her wrist injury a month ago. She did come back last week, but had to withdraw after two rounds. So she's dealing with that. A couple missed cuts in addition to the injury that she's dealing with. Ataya Titicul is one of the other players that you could put in that category that might be playing the best of anybody in the world. But beyond that, Nelly Korda's had a couple missed cuts, a fourth place on the Ladies European Tour. And then Minji Lee had three missed cuts in a row prior to going into Korea. So it was one of those where you kind of saw it building. But in addition to that, what else is going on in the landscape is putting Lydia Ko at the top of my mind in the top of the world.
Eamon, I mean, to see Lydia Ko and where she is at this point of her career, I mean, she and Jordan Spieth had a lot of parallels with the great heights they reached at such a young age, the drop-offs. She's now once again on the ascension and leading the LPGA Tour Player of the Year race. How would you characterize her story?
It feels as though she's in the third chapter now. She's gone from the phenom through the struggles, and now she seems to have found a sweet spot, a comfort zone, if you will. She's made 20 starts this year, and she has the two wins, but she's got nine top fives, no missed cuts at all. In fact, you've got to go back 36 tournaments to find a cut that Lydia Ko missed. So she's got a striking level of consistency she's found, which is why she's up to number three in the Rolex rankings right now. What you kind of want to see is that translate back into the major championships with Lydia. You've the same narrative followed her a little bit that has followed Rory McIlroy. Her last major championship win was the Chevron back in 2016. That was her second major title. Since then, she's had 11 top 10s. Five of those have been top three finishes. And, you know, she's been in the top seven in most of the majors this year as well. So she's here, there or thereabouts, all the time when it comes to tournament play. She doesn't take weekends off. She doesn't take big tournaments off. And in a way, you could almost argue it's surprising that this is only her second win of the year, because she's such a commanding lead in the Vera Trophy for scoring average on the LPGA Tour that just proves that she doesn't seem to have bad days.
Yeah, and you mentioned Rory McIlroy. You could also put Jordan Spieth, last major win, 2017 Open. Lydia Ko had that amazing run winning the Evian, the last major of 2015, the first one of 2016. We're thinking, okay, that's two majors at this young an age. She's still a teenager. What can she potentially be capable of? And if you're sitting on this desk, then you see a small sample size and you extrapolate, what can that lead to? Oh, 10 plus majors in her career. It's kind of shocking that she's been stuck on that number, but it seems like her game is as close as it's been in the last 6 years to go from two to three.
And that just leaves the question of how long she wants to do it. I mean, she was quite emotional about having won in South Korea, where she was born, even though she plays under the New Zealand flag. It was also the first time her father saw her compete in 2.5 years because of the pandemic. And she talked afterwards about the fact that she's getting married at the end of this year as well. So there's a question, at what point does Lydia's attention span turn away from competitive golf to whatever the next chapter of her life is going to be? She has said in the past she was going to walk away by the age of 30. Well, that's still 5 years away. She's accomplished so much and still just 25 years old. But I guess it comes down to what is the level of ambition in the long term to try to compile those records.
Yeah. I mean, motivation's a hard thing to quantify. So you wonder if that will carry her through her 20s and beyond that 30 benchmark that she had set. I've talked with guys on the PGA Tour who've said, oh, I'm going to retire at this age. And then they go right past it, because then you fall back on, do I still want to feel this adrenaline inside the ropes? Some people can't get away from that. It's hard to evolve into the next stage of life when that's what you've been working for your entire career. And for a lot of athletes, there's no greater high than that experience of competition. I don't know if Lydia's necessarily wired that way. She seems like kind of a different cat in a sense, where she has grand ambitions inside the game, but it seems like she could also have a happy, fulfilling life when she eventually walks away from the game.
And there's also evidence that both can be accomplished as well. We've seen mothers win on the LPGA Tour. I would argue, yeah, Julie Inkster is the gold standard of that, who won multiple majors as a mother. So it's not an either-or proposition, but it does at some point raise the question, when Lydia gets married, if she wants to start a family, at what point does the focus have to diffuse a little bit? And does she step away? Does she come back? Because she's compiling an absolutely incredible record in this game for someone who is still so young comparatively.
Yeah, I mean, she's en route to a Hall of Fame career, right on the precipice of that occurring. But golf is such an inherently selfish endeavor that the hidden reps that you have to put in to maintain an elite level of play, you have to sacrifice a lot of personal time with family to allow your game to stabilize at a high level that you're accustomed to playing.
And those 18 victories now that she's got, that ties her on the LPGA's all-time wins list with Meg Mallon and Hollis Stacey. That's pretty rarefied air to be getting in up there.
You could definitely say that.
But for more on the LPGA Tour, we welcome in Golf Week senior writer Bethan Nichols. And Bethan, that was a pretty dominant, a pretty dominant performance at the weekend from Lydia Ko. What was your takeaway from that victory?
Well, it was an emotional victory for her, obviously winning on South Korean soil with her father there for the first time since COVID to watch her compete in person. So very special. But, you know, when I look at Lydia and I listen to her comments, you know, I think this is, it's just so fun, first of all, to see her making another run for the number one ranking in the world again. But this is a different Lydia, obviously, than we saw all those years ago. She was last ranked number one in 2017, and she's getting married this December. She's 25 years old. And when you talk about longevity in a career, this is a player who from the beginning has said she wants to retire by age 30. So, you know, we're really not talking about a lot of golf left when you look at it from that perspective. But, you know, Lydia's saying this is the most consistent golf of her career. She talks a lot about how much the tour has changed since she's been out here. So I decided to look a little bit at the numbers. Lydia, of course, is leading the tour in scoring. She's currently ahead of the Vera Trophy race. And right now there are 14 players who are averaging under 70 on tour. And when Lydia won in 2012 as a 15-year-old, there were zero players on tour averaging below 70. There were a couple ahead of that, you know, in years prior, but usually one or two, Annika, maybe add in a Seiri. But then when you look at how many players are averaging below 72, below par, right now you have 102 on the LPGA. And back when Lydia won for the first time in 2012, only 34. So yes, the LPGA is a lot deeper than it was when she first came out and broke through. When you look at, she talks about how cut lines are different. She's right on the money there as well. They're two strokes lower than they were 10 years ago. The winning score is three strokes lower than it was 10 years ago. Now, it hasn't changed as much in recent years, but when you look at the scope of the amount of time that Lydia Ko's been on tour, it has changed quite dramatically.
Bethan, Lydia Ko also leads the Player of the Year race. I want you to handicap it for the rest of the season as we're getting close to the end of the year. You think she's going to end up pulling it up?
Well, when you look at the direction that she's going versus the direction that Minji Lee's going, who's the one that's only a point below her, you have to give the nod here to Lydia Ko. But then when you look a couple down to Ataya Titikun and you realize that, you know, a victory is worth 30 points and she has two tournaments left. She obviously dipped a little bit on Sunday, but she was the overnight leader going into the final round, Ataya, that is, that, you know, she has a lot to play for and could certainly wind up as Player of the Year as well. So it's a really fun dynamic as we head into the end of the season. We look at the fact that we have a teenager and Ataya trying to become the first teenager to rise to number one since Lydia Ko, looking to be potentially become Player of the Year and Rookie of the Year all in the same season, while you have this comeback story with Lydia Ko playing out as well. So I just love the dynamic of those two very different storylines.
Bethan, Lydia Ko is getting married at the end of this year. Do you anticipate a change in focus over the next couple of years for her?
Well, look, married life changes everything, right? So there's no question that life is going to change for Lydia Ko in a dramatic way. But I think we can already see that she's in a very happy place in her life. So I expect good things. She's already, you know, playing less golf than she did in her youth. but you know, she says she's not going to slow down. She still wants to compete. I don't think she's going to play another 10 years. I really don't. But I definitely think that, you know, she's going to have to make some compromises because that's the name of the game in marriage. But I see her being very happy and fulfilled, honestly, and enjoying this next chapter, knowing that it's not going to last forever.
Another storyline to follow, Na Yun Choi announcing she would retire this past weekend following the event in South Korea. What's been so special about her journey?
You know, when I think about Na Yun Choi, I don't just think about the fact that she won nine times on tour. She won the U.S. Women's Open, obviously following the footsteps of Seiri at Black Wolf Run. When I think about Na Yun, I think about the fact that just in her second year on tour, she had a really tough conversation with her parents. And, you know, she told me she was in the bathroom crying. She just had another top 10 finish. but her parents, who are in a very good natured way, well-meaning, around, you know, what went wrong, that she only finished in the top 10. And so, you know, Nayeon very politely asked if they would go back to South Korea and let her do this on her own and be in the, and that was a big step. And there you see Nayeon Choi making an ace on her way out the door for a brand new BMW. What a way to go out. but you know, that was a really big deal for Nayeon, and I think it really, you know, sent a nice message to other players that there's more than one way to do this, and you can be independent out there. She hired an English tutor who traveled the world with her. She took that very seriously, and she really kind of was vulnerable in how she played out her life on tour and the struggles that she had, and I really appreciate that, because I think it's so important for younger players to hear from older players talk about, you know, the tough parts, how hard it can be, even when you're at the top and you're winning and you're playing really well, and you feel like you can't talk about the other struggles that you're feeling, because why should you be complaining? You're winning, you're on top of the game, you know. So I just really appreciate the vulnerability that Nayeon has showed over the years.
Speaking of tough times at the top, Bethan, rounds of 80, 79 for Jin Young Ko and a withdrawal. Any updates on her health?
Her manager tells me that she's currently undergoing treatment, as you can imagine, for that wrist still. It sounds like, you know, she might have come back too soon. But she's still hopefully going to come back in November and play those last two events in Florida. It doesn't sound like she has any plans to shut it down for the rest of the year, that she's going to give it a go. So that's nice to hear. And I have to say that I loved her Instagram post today. She said it just was three simple things: accept, think, move on. And I think that she's accepting that it was a disaster last week. She's going to think about how she might do it differently and what her plan is going forward, and then move on. And I don't think you could ask for anything more.
Wise words from Jin Young Ko and Bethan Nichols as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Every club pro's dream in America, who wants to chase it, is when I turn 50, what could be with the PGA Tour champ? Maybe I'll be the guy who qualifies, who, like a Ken Tanigawa, only had four starts on the PGA Tour, wound up a winner on the PGA Tour champions. But then they turn 50, and you see a Fred Couples shoot 60 on Sunday, and you realize, oh, yeah, Goliath and these household names that I'm familiar with, they're still really damn good, and it is a really hard tour to play your way on. Stephen Elker, last summer when he turned 50, had to Monday qualify, rode a heater of top 10 finishes into the playoffs, wound up winning to secure a spot this year. That in and of itself was an amazing story. Now he's basically a lock to win the Schwab Cup. So he's gone from this journeyman who is just fighting to survive, to keep his card, to figure out how to make ends meet, to he is now going to be in the top echelon of PGA Tour Champions players and will etch his mark in PGA Tour Champions history with the season.
And it's easy to forget just how much grinding he's done over the years, George. I mean, the PGA Tour Champions is just his latest stop, probably the last stop of his career. But he's played PGA Tour events. He's played Korn Ferry events. He's played DP World Tour events, the European Challenge Tour, the Australasian Tour, the Asian Tour, the Canadian Tour. This guy has played everywhere. He has racked up more miles than anyone this side of an airline pilot in the game of professional golf. And he's learned to win. He has picked up victories over the years, but he learned how to grind it out there. And particularly now, he's in a race that rewards consistency. And there is nobody out there more consistent, because not only does he have the four victories, he's been second four times. He's been third four times as well. It's an actual shocking occurrence if Stephen Elker finishes outside the top five on the PGA Tour Champions. And in a race that is awarding points for high finishes week in, week out, that's almost impossible for guys like Padraig Harrington or Gerry Kelly or Steve Stricker behind him to beat.
Was on the broadcast with Lanny Watkins, the World Golf Hall of Famer, and Phil Blackmore. And Phil Blackmore and I were talking before the final round. We're like, all right, what's changed? Like, you can't just suddenly have a game that couldn't compete on the PGA Tour. And my thought was, well, he didn't have the distance to compete. Courses are a different length, et cetera. But Phil was challenging me and saying, part of it's got to be belief also. When you start seeing some success, it starts to have this built-in buy-in that, hey, I have the confidence to not only contend, but to win. And you talk about where Stephen Elker has been with his golf game, the long road that he's taken. I was looking it up. The first time he ever got world ranking points was all the way back in 1989 18-year-old, New Zealand Open, finished top 10 that week. So he's had world ranking points now in five different decades to ultimately get to this point where he's the front runner to win the Schwab Cup playoffs, as well as the likely player of the year on the PGA Tour Champions.
Yeah, when you look at this lineup here, because points are doubled over the playoff events, I would argue, George, the only way Stephen Auker is not winning this is if he shows up in the live event this week in Miami. That's literally the only way Stephen Auker is not taking home the $1 million bonus for Charles Schwab Cup standings. He just is in a commanding position. And not only do Harrington and guys like Stricker have to play really, really well for the next two events, but they have to rely upon Stephen Auker underperforming, and there's just no evidence that he's doing that at all.
Yeah, mathematically, I mean, like, the only shot really is for Padraig Harrington to win the next event, and then Stephen Auker to finish dead last, or Jerry Kelly to win the last two, or Steve Stricker's been on a hiatus for him to come back. It's just all these nearly implausible scenarios. There's a very good chance that he can lock it up in Boca at the TimberTech Championship, where I'll be next week, and then just have the finale be completely devoid of any drama because of how dominant he has been for the entirety of this year. It's been amazing.
Do you think Stephen will regret the absence of drama by the time we get to that finale, or is he just going to be enjoying it? Because the guy has all the weapons. You know, he's top 20 in driving distance, top 10 in accuracy, number one in putting. He's leading the scoring average comfortably as well. You just look for a weak spot in this guy. It's kind of hard to find it.
Would you want drama, or would you just like to have some added
zeros? I'm a spectator. I always like the drama, but if somebody's offering me a check for $1 million, I'd forego the drama.
Picking up what you're laying down right there. So can't leave without another look at the trophy. And the greenskeeper probably just cringing. What a great moment in Richmond, Virginia. Stephen Auker with a dream season that continues. We're going to have much more on golf today. Coming up on the other side of this short break. So we have seen this weekend's winners. Now for the winners who didn't win. That's how Eamon Lynch and I are often described. But who do you have as a winner who didn't?
We're the losers who can't stop losing, George.
That's why we're sharing a desk together.
I look at a guy like Tommy Fleetwood, who had a really good week, finished tied fourth at Congaree in the CJ Cup. He was also tied fourth in the Open at St. Andrews. He was tied fourth in the Genesis Scottish Open. So I guess if it's a test of imagination as much as ball striking, then Tommy Fleetwood's your guy out there. And he's fallen off quite a bit over the years. Back at the Arnold Palmer Invitation in March, he was down to 50th in the world. This is a guy who had been in the top 10. He's now gotten himself up again inside the top 25. As of this morning, he's 24th in the world. But he was such a strong ball striker and a strong putter for so long. But he fell off a couple of years ago. His off-the-tee strokes gained got him down to 145th. He's got that back up to 77th. So far this year through a couple of starts, and his putting, which had dropped to 136th, is now up to 12th. So he's a guy who seems to be moving in the right direction. Let's just see some results that continue on golf courses that aren't necessarily as quirky and where the ground game matters as much, because that's really where he's shown success in the second half of this year, is in the imagination, the ground game, the kind of linksy golf that he grew up with. But he's definitely moving in the right direction for sure.
More how the game is played globally than what we see week in and week out on the PGA Tour, with more of the ground game being utilized. Was talking a bit with Tommy Fleetwood at the CJ Cup. Such an easy guy to root for, just so generous with his time with the media, for the fans. He had showed that flash at the U.S. Open at Shinnecock when he has the putt for 62, winds up finishing second to Brooks Koepka, and we thought, okay, his career arc, he's going to be a contender in majors, a stalwart on European Ryder Cup teams. He has the game that will translate to success on the PGA Tour. Still waiting to see that first victory over here, but a great start to the season with that T4 at the CJ Cup.
And he's 3 years removed from his last win, which was the Nedbank in South Africa back in November of 2019. But he has shown a bit of form this year in the major championships as well. He had fifth place finishes both at Southern Hills and in the Open Championship this year. So he's definitely trending in the right direction. When you look at the guys or ladies who just came up short this weekend, who didn't leave with the trophy but didn't leave empty-handed, they can take some positive away from it. Who are you looking at?
I'm not going with the human. I'm going with the golf course.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to go with Congaree, which I think had been kind of an under-the-radar course. It hosted the Palmetto Championship last year. You had started hearing some hype and build-up about what this layout's like in Ridgeland, South Carolina, Tom Fazio design, and what the family, the freaking family, is doing with Congaree, how they have ambassadors instead of members, all part of the Congaree Global Golf Initiative, gives back to programs in the area for kids who don't have necessarily the same academic opportunities that you would see elsewhere through the game of golf. It's been great to see what that program has done in the build-up over 4 to 5 years. It was nice to see, with more prominent voices in the game of golf, having 15 of the top 20 at the CJ Cup, their reaction to what this course is. And talking with Bones before the start of the tournament, who's on the bag for Justin Thomas, he said it's one of the most strategic courses I've seen. And the appreciation for it up front really tells the story of Congaree. Looks great on TV, but once you're there in person watching these guys navigate it, it's so different than what we see week in and week out on the PGA Tour. I thought it was refreshing, and the feedback from the golf world and from the big names was tremendous.
I would totally agree with you on that. To me, it was a really interesting tournament to watch, because the most interesting part of the journey of every golf ball seemed to happen after it hit the ground. Mm-hmm. And we even saw in some of the highlights earlier when Kirk Kitayama drove the 15th. He's just kind of using the contours to funnel the ball where it needs to go. We saw Rory McIlroy do that as well around the greens with great dexterity this weekend as well. It's a fantastic golf course. It's demanding from the neck up as well as in terms of just beyond physical skill. It tests patience. And I thought John Rahm's patience was getting a little frayed with a couple of breaks in terms of chip shots not getting where he wanted them, and clogged lies and bunkers. So it does wear you down. But it's a fantastic place with two directors of golf there, and Bruce Davidson and John McNeely, both of whom I've hired and fired for disappointing me and not delivering an immediate response to my golf game, George. That's a long list, though.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know that we have enough. How much time do we have left? We got 35 minutes. We might not be able to fit it all in. The other cool part with Congaree, real quick, it's not often on the PGA Tour that you have a family environment where you see guys dining together. A lot of players will have their own chef, or they're staying offsite, or they're doing this or that. It's rare to see guys dining and you have this communal experience. Congaree kind of facilitates that, where guys are in after their rounds or after a practice round, and you see 10, 15, 20 guys in the restaurant right there at the bar, swapping stories, catching up. Yeah. So it was a special week, and it was great that it was broadcast for the golf world to see what it really embodies.